Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. For July 14th, 2022, it's the lowest approval rating edition. I'm David Plotz in Washington, D.C., back from Vermont, sadly back from Vermont. I am joined, as per usual, by John Dickerson of CBS News. Hello, John, from New York.
Hello, David.
And Emily is yon and beyond. I don't even know where she is on vacation. I hope relaxing, deservedly relaxing somewhere. And we have a special guest, I think his debut hosting the Gabfest, I believe. Certainly not his debut appearance. Mark Leibovich of The Atlantic, author of Thank You for Your Servitude, fantastic new book that came out this week about Trump's lackeys, minions, and lickspittles that we're going to be talking about. Mark, welcome to the Gabfest. Hello.
So good to be here, David, John. Happy to be here in any capacity. I've always been considered myself a friend of the Gabfest, occasional visitor, but this is a whole new capacity, so it's an honor.
This week on the Gabfest, why is President Joe Biden so unpopular, and could it get even worse for him? Then we will talk to Mark about his darkly comic new book and about the recent January 6th committee revelations. Then Herschel Walker knows almost nothing about anything, exaggerates, lies, and misleads, has a worrisome personal history, and will still probably be elected senator from Georgia. We will talk about that. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. Joe Biden's approval rating is 33%, which is lower, I think. It's a different pollster, but lower than Trump's was at the end of his presidency. Most Democrats say they want someone else to be their 2024 Democratic presidential nominee. Biden, who's already the oldest president, would be fantastically, unprecedentedly old if he were reelected, and 86 when he finished a second term. Meanwhile, only 13% of Americans say the country is on the right track. And that poll was taken before this week's dismal inflation news. So, Mark, how much of what's going on with Biden do you think has to do with the general unpleasantness of the country right now, in the sense that almost everything is going in the wrong direction? And how much of the dissatisfaction with him has to do with the fact that he has just done a kind of mediocre job and seems really old and is really old?
He is really old. I think a lot of it is the first. Here's a couple of unfortunate things about Joe Biden that he can't change. One, his age. But two, he's a guy who got elected and he peaked the day he got elected. The most important thing Joe Biden could have done is beat Donald Trump. That's why everyone that was the overriding reason he was chosen as the Democratic nominee. He beat Donald Trump. He, sort of landed the plane. He was there. He behaved like a grown-up. He didn't tweet like a madman in the middle of the night. He was decent to people. That sort of wore off with Afghanistan. So, he's been in this spiral ever since. And one thing I don't agree with is that he is incapable of reversing this in any way. I think the second he says, "I'm not running again, I was elected to restore order, to calm things down at the most divisive and deranged moment in recent history. And my job is done. We have big challenges. I want to turn it over to the next generation. I acknowledge that I'm going to be 80 in a few months. And, I feel like, it's time for new leadership. And I feel like, I'm going to focus entirely in the next 2.5 years on, my job and then
move on. So do you think that's a realistic scenario, either of you? Is he temperamentally capable of saying that?
Joe Biden has always been very stubborn. And on this point, he's also been very stubborn, which is that you're either on your way up in politics or you're on your way down. As soon as you signal that you're on your way down, you're a lame duck, people stop taking you seriously and you lose all your juice. Even when he was vice president to President Obama, and no one really thought that he would be, the president, everyone thought that was sort of the emeritus role for old Joe Biden. He never ruled it out because he liked the idea that he could somehow be in play, even hypothetically, and people would look at him differently. I think it's a different scenario now. I think a huge majority of the country and a good number of Democrats don't want him to run. I think it would immediately make him unthreatening. I think it would just completely change the air around him, and I think for the better.
I think two challenges are, one, before the 2022 midterms, if he were to say this, to the extent that that race is a referendum on the president, he would be essentially accepting the negative referendum and would be validating the idea that he's been a disaster by saying that before the midterms. He would also rob the party to the extent it has any spokesperson for a national message. He would be replacing that with, who the hell's the spokesperson for the party, which you need if you're trying to get everybody on the same page, which is hard enough to do as a Democrat. So I think that's would be a challenge to do beforehand. And then, as Mark says, there's no evidence he would do that. Afterwards, it depends what the shape of the House and the Senate is. Immediately, you would kick off another round of a fight that's already going on about who would then be the nominee. And everything that was said by anyone, from Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders to Pete Buttigieg to Kamala Harris, would be sifted through that prism, which would be chaos for Biden's agenda and his legacy, and also put him like way on the sidelines of national affairs, which would be just a very weird place to be for a sitting president. And he wouldn't stand for that. He would get itchy and it would be chaos.
John, you think there are these sort of reasons having to do with the chaos that's unleashed that he would be reluctant to do it? You think temperamentally he's reluctant to do it? On the other hand, his party seems to want him not to run. There is a absolutely. And it doesn't, you don't have to be a 22-year-old to think that the Democratic Party is unreasonably dominated by incredibly old people. It's not, of course, just Biden. It's Nancy Pelosi. It's Clyburn. It's Hoyer. Like the top of the party leadership is absurdly old. And it would be great to sweep that out and get some newer blood in there. So is there any chance that he does what Mark is saying is a possibility, or Mark is saying might be tactically wise?
We're giving all the reasons why it would be bad for him to do it. I think, as I said on our live show, I think he doesn't run again. I think that something has to change for the Democratic fortunes.
I mean, I would say that, I mean, first of all, a Democratic president, whether he's running again or not, is going to be the spokesman for the party. I mean, it's just when you're the president of the United States, you do have that bully pulpit. And it's not like the bully pulpit is being used very powerfully now, you know, because he might be up for re-election. I mean, he hasn't been a good spokesman for the party right now. He's a terrible cheerleader at this point. You know, maybe an earlier, younger version of Joe Biden might have been more effective. I don't know why this scenario has not been talked up more. And I'm also, I mean, the chaos of a you know, not having a successor, I mean, that's called a primary. That's what happens. I mean, yeah, Kamala Harris is by no means a natural heir apparent at this point. But, you know, it wouldn't be the worst thing to have Gavin Newsom and Stacey Abrams or AOC or Chris Murphy or Amy Klobuchar or whoever, sort of actually people under, I assume they're all under at least 65, at least six, I mean, they're quite young, just debating the future of America, of the Democratic Party. I mean, I think just thinking about it makes me feel 10 years younger. So I don't know. I don't think that would be unhealthy at this point. I think it would signal to America, to, you know, independents, that this is a party that is not afraid of its future. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump is he's made Republicans very risk averse. They just walk around like they're waiting for like a big orange light fixture to fall on their head because, you know, the next tweet, the next statement, whatever. Democrats have also been made risk averse by Donald Trump because they're afraid of taking any kind of risk whatsoever with a new face. It's like, all right, Joe Biden scares the fewest number of people. He's seen as the most electable. Let's make him nominee in 2020. So you have this very caretakery, risk-averse president. And, you know, he did what he had to do. He got elected. And good for him. Unfortunately, you know, reality had to take over at a certain point.
I mean, it's really hard to see how a Democratic Party that goes into 2024 with the same set of people at the top of it is headed for a victory, headed for retaking a House and Senate it loses in the midterms, is headed for, you know, a sweeping presidential victory over Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump. It really, it's evident that they need new people. So, like, sooner the better. I want to close talking about the same poll had data about Republicans and Trump, and notably that half of Republicans want Trump to be their presidential nominee in 2024 and half don't. And of the half that don't, most or half of them So 25% overall want Ron DeSantis as their nominee. When you saw those results, Mark, did you think, oh, wow, Trump is in a weak position, or, oh, wow, Trump is in a strong position vis-a-vis his party?
I think if you were to have a poll probably in 2015, you would have seen, you know, late 2015, you would have seen basically the same numbers, probably 40-50% said, yeah, I'm a Trump person. And then the other 50% would be split among Jeb Bush and Rubio or Cruz, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, he still has his core. And I don't buy, I mean, it'd be one thing if Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, whoever else might run, decided, you know what, I am going to subvert my ambition and my ego and throw in with Ron DeSantis because that's what I'm going to do because I think it's important that we stop Donald Trump. That's not going to happen. I mean, first of all, Ron DeSantis doesn't seem to have a lot of goodwill beyond like whatever, you know, very default polling, you know, power he seems to have. But yeah, if he had the field to himself, maybe it would be a clean race, but I doubt he will. And also, I'm not convinced DeSantis is going to scale well at all. I mean, people like Republicans who know him, who served with him in Congress, Republican governors. I mean, he's a weird dude, not charismatic. You can imagine Trump just like absolutely caricaturing him in the most Trumpy ways possible. He's not a sure thing to even get reelected in Florida. I mean, it's not like he's beloved down there. So I don't know. I don't see that. And I'm not sure how informed people are about what kind of guy this guy is.
I think you've put your finger on exactly the challenge. The only thing I would add is that to just affirm what Mark was saying, in this New York Times poll, Trump loses to Biden, despite how bad things Biden are for Biden in a head to head. But Trump's 49% in his party is actually 5 points higher than the 44% of the vote he got in the primaries in 2016. Now, he was a sitting president, so you would expect his number to be higher, but relative to, you know, this just affirms Mark's point, which is that he can have enough support in the party to get the nomination, and it doesn't have to be overwhelming.
Slate Plus members, you get so much good stuff from Slate. You get member-exclusive episodes and segments from us and from other shows. You have no ads on any Slate podcasts. You get unlimited reading on the Slate site. And of course, the enormous psychological satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting the work that Slate is doing. That is in itself priceless. And today we have a bonus segment for Slate Plus members about Mark Leibovich's new book and how he reported it and how you go about reporting in Washington these days. How do you get people to talk to you in time when there's so much mistrust of the media? People ought to know better than to talk to Mark Leibovich, and yet they do talk to Mark Leibovich. How do you go about doing that? So go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today and hear that segment and get everything else you get as a member. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Mark Leibovich, in addition to being a brilliant writer for The Atlantic and formerly The New York Times, is a writer of books and a chronicler, in particular, of Washington. His last book about D.C., This Town, began with a funeral, and it was one of the funniest scenes in recent D.C. political writing. And the book itself was also very, very funny. This book, Mark's new book, Thank You for Your Servitude, begins in a hotel, not at a funeral. And somehow that hotel is so much more grim and depressing than a funeral could be. Thank You for Your Servitude is a really dark sequel to This Town, Mark's last book about D.C., which was about the peripheries of powerful Washington, the people who are just a few inches outside the inner circle, who matter, but not as much as they want to matter. And Thank You for Your Servitude is also about that set of people. In this case, it's the story of people who were compromising themselves for Donald Trump, and a few people who didn't compromise themselves for Donald Trump. The people who compromised, like Lindsey Graham, like Kevin McCarthy, other denizens of the hotel that Mark writes about, the Trump Hotel, of course. So, Mark, congratulations and thank you for your servitude. It's a very funny book. It's a very dark book. I can't tell if it's the book that we need at this time or the book that we absolutely don't need at this time, but it's one or the other, so people should get it. I'm going to ask you, Mark, just to read a paragraph I sent you yesterday about who you're writing about, and thank you for your servitude.
Better objects of our scrutiny and far more compelling to me are the slavishly devoted Republicans who Trump drew to his side. It's been said before, but can never be emphasized enough. Without the complicity of the Republican Party, Donald Trump would be just a glorified geriatric fox-watching golfer. I've interviewed scores of these collaborators trying to understand why they did what they did and how they could live with it. These were the McCarthys and the Grahams and all the other busy parasitic suck-ups who made the Trump era work for them, who humored and indulged him all the way down to the last exhausted strains of American democracy.
Mark, your colleague at The Atlantic, Anne Applebaum, has written really chillingly about collaborators in the context of dictatorships like Putin's Russia or quasi-dictatorships like Orban's Hungary. I'm not saying that Lindsey Graham is equivalent to necessarily somebody who collaborates with Vladimir Putin, but why is it that so few people stand up and risk their careers for something they know to be wrong, which Lindsey Graham knows, which Kevin McCarthy knows, which Chris Christie knows?
That to me is the one of the central questions of our time. I mean, I think one of the reasons I wanted to focus on them is because if there was one undercovered aspect of the Trump story, it's not Trump himself. It's not White House intrigue itself. It's not Trump voters themselves. I mean, much effort has gone into trying to understand the motivations of Trump voters and trying to, you know, get the killer White House anecdote about Donald Trump, you know, feeding Mike Pence dog food or whatever it is. I wanted to understand the people in the middle, the putative leaders of the Republican Party, and why they were sort of throwing in with him, even though they all knew better. And that was always a working title for me in my head. They all knew better. Because, you know, Lindsey Graham, Kevin McCarthy, Republicans up and down privately have great contempt for the guy. They think he's as dangerous as many people do. Publicly, the level of slavish sort of sycophancy, just unctuousness is just off the charts. There's never been a bigger gap between what politicians will say publicly and privately, in my experience, than, you know, ever in my experience covering this stuff. You know, their motivations obviously are different. A lot of it is sort of pure, good, old-fashioned opportunism. I need my job. I need to keep my job. I'm Lindsey Graham. I probably need my U.S. Senate seat more than any other U.S. senator. That's what one of his colleagues says. I just need to be here. I need to be in the mix. I need to be at the dice table. Kevin McCarthy needs to be Speaker of the House. He has decided that all the indignity he has undergone over the last few years will all be redeemed if somehow Republicans can win a majority in November and he can be their leader. So those are two pretty naked calculations. Others, just it's just a path of least resistance. There's the factor of like physical fear and intimidation. I mean, a lot of people are just genuinely like physically afraid of the death threats they're getting, you know, their families are getting. You know, Donald Trump is not at all hesitant to summon the mob, as we've seen, quite literally. And that's a factor, too, that I don't think should be underestimated here either.
The thing I find interesting are the different categories. I think people would have been less surprised that Kevin McCarthy did all the things necessary to stay in line with Donald Trump and his supporters than they would have been Lindsey Graham. Because Lindsey Graham had styled himself in the shadow of John McCain as an independent, tells it like it is. The Republican Party's got to stop hitching its fortunes only to white men. So he both stylistically and as a matter of policy was kind of pushing against the party, and then obviously pushed against Trump when he was running. So for him to become one of not only Trump's enablers, but I mean, he got on the phone and called Brad Raffensperger after the election. I mean, he was an operative in the Trump effort to overthrow a free election as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. So what is your thinking, Mark, about the distinction between those two? Because Kevin McCarthy never made a big deal about, I've got these independent morals and values that are sterling, but Lindsey Graham really did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are gradations up and down the ladder. I mean, I mentioned Paul Ryan to people. Paul Ryan, he disappointed a lot of people, certainly in the Trump world, when he was Speaker of the House for the first 2 years of Donald Trump's term. He certainly didn't win over anyone on the left. I mean, he was seen as basically a lapdog. He got his tax cuts, but he basically had had enough. I mean, Paul Ryan is someone I spent a fair amount of time with in 2018. And also a few months ago, and was really, I mean, I thought kind of genuinely tortured by this. And there's an anecdote in the book where a couple months ago I visited him and he described for me what it was like to sort of be sitting at home watching the January 6th riot kind of unfold on his TV and just bursting into tears. He's John Boehner's the crier. I'm not a crier, but there I was bursting into tears, like crying like a baby. And it was, he said it was very emotional and I just couldn't believe it. And I saw my old security detail like going mano a mano with these rioters. And, it sounded very compelling. And finally I broke in. I said, Mr. Speaker, I thank you for telling me this, but were any of these tears of complicity? I mean, did you ever think, maybe I could have done more when I was Speaker? Maybe I should speak louder now, and maybe I shouldn't be on the board of Fox News, because he continues to serve on the board of Fox News, cashes a big paycheck. And, he didn't want to go there. People make calculations, and it's never a clean, straight-ahead thing. But that's not to say I think Paul Ryan is duping me. I think his experience with Donald Trump was not pleasant. I spent enough time around him to know this. And, Mitch McConnell, I think, probably doesn't get enough blame for letting Trump, the way Mitch McConnell handled himself after January 6th, I think, is, quite typically Mitch McConnell, but also quite insidious in that he very strongly said this is a terrible thing. Donald Trump is responsible for it. He privately was saying, let's impeach the guy. He was basically suggesting that he be indicted. And then almost single-handedly orchestrated the impeachment so that, we don't have time to do this in 2 weeks. And of course they did. It's not like they need to make a case. They all lived through January 5th or 6th. And he said, nope, got to wait till after the inauguration. And so then his members didn't have to take that vote, even though I think the vote probably would have to be convicted if it were, timely enough. And then after January 20th, they had their easy answer, which is, oh, he's a former president. Why bother impeaching him? And then a couple of weeks later, McConnell's like, of course I will support the nominee. And so, cute Mitch McConnell doesn't get talked about a lot here. And, McCarthy has to go down to Mar-a-Lago. But basically, this is why we're back here today with the Republican Party. He's been fully rehabilitated. And you could argue that thanks to Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, that took a few weeks. So to me, I think they're extremely complicit. I think everyone's complicit, but I think there are gradations, obviously.
I actually want to talk about the heroes, because one of the things that I think you get into well, and thank you for your servitude, are the several people who are quite heroic. And I say this knowing that GabFest listeners don't think Mitt Romney is heroic. They don't think John McCain is heroic. They think John McCain is, a conservative Republican. And they don't think Liz Cheney, daughter of Dick Cheney, the Darth Vader of the Bush years, is necessarily heroic. I guess that makes her Luke Skywalker, though, if she's Darth Vader's child. Liz Cheney's bravery during this January 6th commission and her willingness to stand up and just torpedo her own political career is extraordinary. What makes these people different, and how do you guys think we can mint more of them?
My feeling on this is, I have such little patience for my liberal friends who you mentioned. Liz Cheney inspires me. I think, the idea that, first of all, I love the way the hearings are being conducted. I think the fact that she's placed her career on the line, basically lost a chance possibly to be Speaker of the House, is probably going to lose her job over this, lost a ton of friends, is inspiring to me. And then a lot of liberal friends will say, oh, well, but what about the Iraq War? What about, Darth Vader's Halliburton racket? It's just like, stop. I'm of the belief, especially in these precarious times, that it's never, ever too late to do the right thing and then stand by it. I mean, her fortitude here has been impressive. And I do think, and I've thought a lot about this, who are the people who actually have the character to stand up like this? And there are some categories. I mean, a lot of them are sort of family legacy people, like, you know, Liz Cheney obviously comes from a like family of politicians, has a very strong sense of history and sort of the idea that a legacy is important. Mitt Romney, same thing. I mean, George Romney, his father, you know, was a kind of an iconoclastic Republican in his day, you know, was against Nixon, very, you know, pioneer for civil rights and got in a lot of trouble in the Republican Party. Even like Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, his father, I think his name was either Lawrence Hogan or Charles Hogan, I'm not sure. He was sort of a backbencher congressman from Maryland who was the first Republican out of nowhere to support the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And it cost him his job. There was a big price to pay. And, you know, Larry Hogan has been, you know, a consistent Trump critic among Republicans. And then there's another category, which is people of faith. I mean, Mitt Romney's in that category. Jeff Flake's in that category. You know, Rusty Bowers, the Arizona official who testified a few weeks ago, he talked a lot about his faith and how he couldn't lie and wouldn't violate his oath. And, you know, and combat veterans, too. I mean, I think McCain's in that category, Adam Kinzinger. So, I mean, there are these classes of people who have seen larger forces at work and tend to see the world in terms of forces bigger than the day-to-day expediencies of pleasing Donald Trump and, you know, getting through their next election, that tend to be more prone to this. Unfortunately, you know, there just aren't that many of them.
Mark Leibovich's book is Thank You for Your Servitude. It's out this week. It's really funny. It's just a great read, as well as being dark and insightful. Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you, David.
Speaking of great reads, as GabFest listeners know, every month we're doing GabFest Reads, where we're doing a special episode where we're interviewing an author about a new book that they have that we really like. And we have a new episode coming July 24th. Emily's interviewing Vanessa Waugh about Waugh's book Forbidden City. So check out GabFest Reads, July 24th, Emily talking to Vanessa Waugh.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Depending on which poll you look at, Herschel Walker, the Republican nominee for Senate in Georgia, is either running neck and neck with incumbent Raphael Warnock or somewhat behind him. Although, given how fast Herschel Walker could run in his prime, I would not want to be neck and neck or behind or slightly ahead of Herschel Walker. He would definitely run you down. There is a very strong chance that Walker, who is a brilliant football player, but one who has a history of erratic behavior, of threats towards women, a person who has no apparent interest in public policy or knowledge of anything, a moral hypocrite, but he has a fighting chance at being the first Black Republican elected to the Senate in Georgia. John, why is the Republican Party, did they nominate someone so obviously troubled, ignorant, and unqualified? And was it just pure cynicism to pick off a few Black voters who would vote for a Black Republican sports star, and they didn't worry that he's totally unsuited to the job?
I think it's a collection of ideas. The star power works in politics, and Herschel Walker is close to Donald Trump, which is helpful in politics, although in Georgia politics, it's a totally different argument. But he doesn't he doesn't run afoul, really, of the problem Donald Trump has in Georgia, which is his fight with the governor and the secretary of state there. But it was not a messy primary. He's a star in the state. And so you would have picked him anyway, leaving because star power matters. Also, the huge headwinds. Biden's approval rating in Georgia is at like 34%. So with a lot of headwinds, you imagine a candidate who's not so good would probably win in Georgia anyway. Popular governor, a Republican governor among Republicans. So there are all kinds of reasons that he should win. It's the latest Atlanta Journal Constitution poll has Warnock up by a few points and polling over 50%. Walker's negatives are, I think, at 49%, 41 positive, 49 negative. So, and Warnock's at 49, 49. So what's interesting about that to me is that Walker is bad enough that he is, and maybe Warnock is good enough, but that they've disconnected from the national environment, which is bad Joe Biden. I should say, in that same poll, Kemp is up 7 points over Stacey Abrams. So there's voters are making some conclusion right now, at least based on that one poll, and the Quinnipiac poll had Walker down by 10 points. It seems like voters in Georgia right now, at least what they're telling pollsters, is they're making a distinct decision about how bad a candidate Herschel Walker is.
In 2010, Mark, Republicans had a great environment. They're running against Obama, who'd lost a lot of his sheen from 2008. It was a midterm election. Lots of vulnerable Democrats open, and they nominated some really crazy people. They nominated Christine O'Donnell in Delaware. They nominated Todd Legitimate Rape Aiken in Missouri. Have they done the same overreach here with Walker and maybe with other folks, maybe with like a Dr. Oz or other folks who are running?
The Democrats' best hope of keeping the Senate is basically Trump coughing up a few seats for them. And you know, Herschel Walker was Trump's idea. There's no question about it. Like, they're old friends, and he, you know, no one recognizes or appreciates star power like Donald Trump. And, you know, Herschel Walker played for the New Jersey Generals. They have personal history. And, you know, Georgia, I mean, you know, he's a legit, you know, icon, sports icon in Georgia. So, you know, and then you put him actually into a campaign and all of his personality defects and, you know, just a lot of just the fact that he's clearly not ready for prime time or politics or even cares about it just sort of makes itself so evident. Georgia is a classic seat that Republicans should win that they very well might not win. Pennsylvania, same thing. I mean, Dr. Oz off to a really bad start. Again, completely Trump's idea. Trump got him elected. And so those are two seats right there that could be decisive. And there could be more. I mean, I think Ohio, I mean, J.D. Vance has, you know, been more innocuous, obviously, than Dr. Oz. And also Ohio is a tougher state for Democrats. But Tim Ryan's a pretty strong candidate for Democrats. And we'll see. But I mean, look, I mean, Trump, I mean, Mitch McConnell and Trump are not at the same purposes here. And clearly, Herschel Walker and Dr. Oz would not be, or Eric Greitens, for that matter, would not be handpicked McConnell candidates for these races. So that could be the deciding factor in the Senate.
And McConnell had said that he banished the 2010 problem, which he clearly hasn't. And we should remind people who don't know that all Republicans have to do is net one seat, and they control the Senate. But now they're facing, you know, Pennsylvania is a Republican seat that could go the wrong way if Dr. Oz is a disaster. Arizona and Georgia were the two pickup opportunities. If Walker is a disaster in Georgia, they lose the opportunity of taking that seat, which should have been pretty easy to pick up. In Arizona, where we have an August 2nd primary, Blake Masters, who's running to unseat Mark Kelly, who was one of the founders, or I guess he helps run Thiel Capital, thinks Trump won in 2020 and has lots of other modeled things in his background. So that's another opportunity that might not work out for Republicans. So then it comes down to basically picking up a seat in Nevada or taking one out of New Hampshire. And those are, you know, that might be harder. The candidates there are not so great either. So it should be within the Senate grasp, and it's looking like it's not. And by the way, Missouri should be a solid Republican hold, and Greitens is, you know, causing some destabilization there.
Yeah. Also, by the way, Wisconsin is a potential pickup for Democrats. Ron Johnson, they're about 50. They're neck and neck, whoever the Democrat is, depends who they nominate. But yeah, that's a potential cushion seat for Democrats.
Right. We'll see. August 9th is when the Democrats will figure out who they go up against Johnson.
So Trump, serial sexual offender, tax cheat, liar. It felt like, okay, now there's no longer any bar for bad behavior in public life. Like you can, he was as bad as you can be. He's almost literally like, you know, top five worst people in America, Donald Trump by some measures. Also traitor, you know, willing to foment a coup against the Constitution of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. It does character still matter? And is that what's going on with Walker is it something else?
It's a really interesting question. I think it doesn't matter when other things are at stake, and which is one of the reasons why it's necessary for parties to keep the apocalyptic thinking going, and particularly for the Republican Party when they're saddled with Donald Trump. You don't defend Donald Trump. You just talk about the apocalyptic things that will happen if the Democrats take power. So character, does it matter? I think that the same Republican women who stayed home in Georgia, which, by the way, Georgia, we should remind everyone, had the thinnest presidential margin in 2020. Biden won by 0.2 points. And Warnock won by 2 percentage points. They were on different election days. But it's a absolutely tight place. And the women who stayed home and didn't vote for Donald Trump, I can guess. I haven't looked inside that Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll. And obviously, say it again, any individual one poll or polling this far from November, has to be looked at for sort of vague signals, but nothing more specific than that. But that would be my guess. What interests me is the Republicans who are voting yes on Warnock and no on Abrams. Who are they? And does that answer your question? And it may very well answer your question in the affirmative about character.
So there was a story in the New York Times a few days ago about the Latino women who are running as pretty MAGA Republicans in Texas and taking advantage of a clear movement of Hispanics out of the Democratic Party, recognizing there's a strong core of conservatism with a strong evangelical flavor as well in Hispanic America. Trump revealed it. And these women are running and are probably going to do pretty well in congressional races and mostly in South Texas. Should we expect something similar in Black America? Walker is a clearly unfit candidate, but he holds views that probably lots of other people have about his socially conservative view. There are a lot of other Black Americans who probably hold this view, but there aren't a lot of Black candidates in the Republican Party. Historically, are we on the cusp of a shift in the way that we seem to be on a cusp of a shift of that for Hispanic America?
I mean, it's entirely possible. I mean, look, I think the bleeding of Hispanic votes for Democrats, complete disaster for Democrats. They've been banking on Latinos as like the core of their coalition, you know, not just in the present, but in the future. I wouldn't surprise me at all if that happened among African Americans.
I mean, it's so deeply weird that the whole Republican, that whole post, 2012 Republican plan, we have to, you know, get soft on these issues and then we'll attract Hispanic and Black voters, and that's essential for the future of the party. They did exactly the opposite, and now they are attracting the Hispanic and potentially the Black voters who weren't interested in them without that, I don't know, what that authoritarian ethos that Trump has brought to it.
And it was Trump who rightly called that about the 2012 autopsy, saying that if Republicans actually followed what Reince Priebus and the Republican Party had diagnosed its problems, it would destroy the party. He didn't follow that, and he became the nominee. One other thing I'd just like to add about this demographic issue is that also the electorate that's going to be important in the off-year elections, suburban districts make up a lot of these races that are going to be key in determining who has control of the House and the Senate. that will be different than the kind of electorate that participates in presidential years. So a lot of us, including me, will make sloppy comments about like what the Republican coalition is and what the Democratic coalition is. And oftentimes I'll be talking about two totally separate different kinds of elections. So I'm just apologizing in advance for that.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. John, when you're done apologizing and you've started drinking and talking about some random bits of ephemera that have flown through the neurons of the Dickerson brain, what will come out of your mouth? What will that chatter be?
My chatter is a wonderful thing that the New York Times did from the 2021-2022 school year, 168 writing prompts to spark discussion and reflection. And it's basically something the Times did each day of the school year, published in the student opinion section, a question. And it asked students to offer their own questions. It's essentially, the questions are essentially, you know, the kind we ask in our conundrum show. So should there be a minimum voting age? If two songs sound alike, is it stealing? Should libraries get rid of late fees? Is it ethical to be a football fan? When should you tip? Do you think we need to change the way math is taught? Anyway, they're great questions. They totally prompt wonderful different kinds of discussion, and the Times has them all listed on one page, and the articles that led to them, and the responses that came in. And I think basically every newspaper should do this in their communities.
That sounds awesome. Also, John, I want to hat tip your chatter from last week, the How Normal Am I chatter you did. I just went and did the How Normal Am I. It was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating. Mark, what is your chatter?
So I'm in Boston now, and I grew up here. And I remember in the 80s, I was a busboy at TGI Fridays on Newbury Street. And it just so happens I'm at a hotel that is near Newbury Street. And I took a little walk to Starbucks this morning, and I was remembering, and I went by the old TGI Fridays, no longer a TGI Fridays. But I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool to be like, you know, 20-year-old me again, knowing what I know now, walking down this street? And if I could come back to be 20 years old again, or however old I was, 20 years old, and know what I know now, then what technological advances from now would I bring back with me if I could bring three? Or anything, like anti-smoking laws or public smoking laws, because, you know, in the 80s, you know, you could pretty much smoke anywhere, relatively speaking, medication, cell phones, you know, laws, norms, internet, whatever. And I was thinking, you know, what would I bring with me? Would I bring a phone with me? Or would I be happy to be 1985 Mark walking around with all of the incredible sophistication I've gained over the last, you know, 30, whatever, however many years, or 40 almost years? Would I want a phone or not? And
who could you call? Also, there's no internet to connect to. It would be pointless.
Well, that's the question. No. Do other people have it or not?
Oh, that's a great question. No, it'd be all or nothing. Would we want phones or would we not? I'm sort of naturally nostalgic. and, you know, maybe it was simpler. Maybe, you know, I'd be watching the baseball game more closely. I don't know. I think I decided that I probably would want the phone, actually.
I don't see that the phone materially contributes to my happiness. It is what employs me, I suppose. But I'm sure I would just do something else that would employ me. Without a phone.
May I interject that while we're going down memory lane here, and given Mark's lineage, did you know that basically I think one of the first podcasts was launched by the New England Patriots in August of 2000? They did a show called PFW in Progress, and it was a live show that was recorded, and you could get it on demand at patriots.com. So I don't know if that technically counts as a podcast, but I think that it was one of the first, you know, or advised for some space in the beginning of this form. I think.
Interestingly, that's the year Tom Brady was drafted. So everyone sort of credits him for turning the fortunes of the Patriots around after years of ineptitude, but maybe it was the podcast.
My chatter is something I read about in CityCast DC, the newsletter that CityCast is doing in Washington, D.C., my hometown, which is great. You should go to dc.citycast.fm to subscribe to it. It's so good. And to listen to our podcast, which is also so good. Anyway, it's about Shutdown D.C., which is a liberal advocacy group, which is now offering a bounty for service industry workers who spot Supreme Court justices in the wild and report them and inform on their whereabouts. Not just all Supreme Court justices, the ones who voted for Dobbs, voted to overturn Roe. And so it's, you can get up to $250 if you tell Shutdown that, Justice Barrett has been spotted at the Anthropology in Georgetown. And then I guess the idea is that people will then gather and harass and protest against Justice Barrett, who is at the Anthropology in Georgetown. And this comes after, of course, Brett Kavanaugh had a dinner at Morton's here in Washington that was disrupted. Although I don't think that Kavanaugh even saw the protesters, but he was hustled out of the restaurant before he did by protesters who were unhappy that he was there. I don't think I like this idea. I don't think that public intimidation of public officials is a good idea. We've seen it with public health officials who were trying to enforce mask mandates and change public health in cities, and they got harassed. We've seen it with school officials who've been really taking a beating over certain issues.
I hate this idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice for Brett Kavanaugh to know that his decision is not welcome, that people don't appreciate his decisions and that they disapprove of his decisions. But is it really that sort of that there is no place to be a person, no place to be a human being, no place to just to live and interact and not be political and not be your Supreme Court justice self and just coach a Little League game or have a dinner? I hate the politicization of every aspect of life, and this seems like part of it. But I'm interested in, so Mark, sounds like you also don't like this form of intimidation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's such a slippery slope, and basically, pretty much every public official will do things that a large proportion or a significant proportion of the population will have strong, perhaps moral objections to. And, why should it stop here? I mean, Congressman so-and-so voted against Bill 723, which, this large group of people is very passionate about. Therefore, let's do a little search function where we can tell everyone where Congressman so-and-so is. And, all of the similarly passionate people are encouraged to go harass this person. I don't know. I think it's an incredibly slippery slope. And I certainly understand the frustration and the anger directed at the court, especially after Roe. But I would prefer that a harassment model not be something that people pursue.
Listeners, you have harassed us with great chatters. You have tweeted them to us at @SlateGabFest. You've emailed them to us at gabfest@slate.com. Something that you're delighted by, you're horrified by, something you've read, something you've seen, something you've listened to. And this week's listener chatter comes from Josie Beyer.
Hi, Political Gabfest. The last few weeks, I have been chattering a lot about a group of four women currently in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They are rowing from San Francisco to Hawaii, trying to break the world record. They left for their trip on June 21st, and it is expected to take them around 5 weeks. They have no support boat and carry all of their food and supplies with them. There are always two people rowing at a time, and they row in two-hour shifts. Whenever they are not rowing, they are taking care of all of their or the boat's other needs. This can include eating, sleeping, navigating, scraping barnacles off the side of the boat, etc. To see pictures or get more information, you can follow their journey on Instagram at LAT35Racing. That's LAT35RACING. With all of the tough news lately, it has been a really nice break to follow these amazing women.
Honestly, I think I'd rather be on Twitter all day than have to row from San Francisco to Hawaii. That terrifies me. It absolutely terrifies me.
It's true. It's hard to put together more things. I guess if the boat were filled with spiders.
Small boat. Yeah.
But that only suggests how much cooler than they are than me, frankly. I mean, I think it's really cool they're doing
it. It's really cool. They're so brave. And it's incredible. Incredible physical feat and brave. And I'm so scared of ocean. I'm so scared of the ocean. I couldn't do it.
It's amazing to, I mean, also it just turns the idea that like going to Hawaii is the most restful thing in the world for one to do. It's like, I cannot think of a more opposite notion than this.
That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. Please follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet your chatter to us there. For Mark Leibovich and his wonderful book, Thank You for Your Servitude, and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? One of the interesting things that Mark Leibovich does is he makes really smart people sometimes look quite ridiculous. He's done it for years. He's reported on DC politics for a really long time. And for years, decades, nay, people have been talking to Mark. And I don't know why some of them do it. I'm not sure why Lindsey Graham or Kevin McCarthy or Chris Christie or Rudy Giuliani talk to somebody like Mark and how he gets them to talk. Because honestly, it just doesn't. I mean, there's so much suspicion of media these days, especially among Republicans. And I'm just curious about the process of doing a book like this and about how Washington reporting has changed in the decades that Mark and John have been doing it. So, Mark, how did you report this book about the Trump, these Trump enablers? Did you just sit in the Trump hotel? Was that the entirety of your reporting?
No, I mean, that was not the entirety of the reporting, but yeah, a lot of reporting is just hanging around and, you know, making yourself, you know, creating your own breaks just by sort of showing up and being opportunistic, but that's, you know, that's journalism school stuff. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's important to sort of acknowledge, you know, built-in advantages you have when you work for a large media institution like the New York Times or, you know, CBS in John's case. Or, you know, it's, you know, people, you know, you have an affiliation. I mean, I never thought that politicians were talking to me because I worked for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Atlantic or whoever. They're talking to an institution and they're ultimately wanting to reach the public in some way. So it's not that I'm the most charming person in the world and they just can't.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.